Brazil ha detto alla Family that the enemies have been trying to advance their malicious political agenda by waging an economic war against the Iranian nation. Reports emerging of U.S. forces transferring hundreds of Daesh terrorists from a prison in northeast Syria to a desert near Iraq's border. The UK says it will offer NATO a major deployment of forces and weapons in Eastern Europe over what it calls Russian hostility. Welcome. Now, Iran's leader says the enemies have been seeking to advance their political plots against Iran through an economic war. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says an economic collapse was a prelude to wicked political goals. According to the leader, enemies sought to pit the Iranian nation against the Islamic establishment. He also said that Iran's economy should not be tied to issues over which officials have no control. The leader made a comment during an address to a group of Iranian men. Now, fresh reports emerging of the U.S. role in northeastern Syria. American forces have transferred 750 Daesh terrorists, most of them foreigners, from a prison in Hasakah province. Russian media are quoting special sources as saying that the detainees have been transferred to a desert in Deir ez-Zor province. U.S. coalition drones perform monitoring operations to secure their exit route until they arrived at their destination near the Tana Bukema. Sources say the transfer process took place in batches, by SUVs and buses. A number of top Daesh leaders who hold Arab, Belgian, and Dutch nationalities were reportedly among the escapees. Last week, Daesh attacked the detention center. Heavy fighting ensued. Kurdish-led forces, who are allies of the U.S. and fighting the Syrian government, run the prison. Syria's UN envoy has blamed Washington for the clashes. Bassam Sabak says that the U.S. is seeking to recycle Daesh and justify American military presence in Syria. Mohammed Ali says this has happened numerous times before in Syria, where U.S. forces have been involved in years of training and transferring Daesh terrorists.
And this, according to analysts, shows the destructive role of the United States in Syria, and it shows that the United States is just using the pretext of fighting Daesh in order to keep occupying parts of Syria. And this is definitely not the first time that Russia refers to the cooperation between the United States and Daesh. Previously, Russia noted that Daesh is actually training that the United States is actually training Daesh terrorists in the base that it's occupying in Al Tanf area on the borderline with Iraq. And just a week ago, last week, the Syrian military prosecution also said it has evidence of the United States training Daesh and facilitating their movements in the Syrian desert near Al Tanf. So they have evidence seeing them moving around inside that base freely. And also we have to point out that all of the U.S.-led coalition airstrikes never defeated Daesh, which puts a lot of question marks on if Daesh is actually in the first place even trying to defeat that terrorist organization.
Now, based on a fresh study, the Pentagon is to blame for what it calls considerable weaknesses and inconsistencies in assessing civilian casualties. The study comes after the U.S. Defense Department admitted that an airstrike in Afghanistan last year killed 10 civilians. Now the Pentagon saying it will take measures to reduce civilian casualties, but it can do so if it has more money.
The United States military has come under intense scrutiny over its procedures to guard against civilian casualties after a high-profile mistaken drone strike in Kabul, Afghanistan, that claimed the lives of 10 civilians, including 7 children, on August 29. The U.S. military initially said it successfully targeted a Daesh terrorist who was linked to the attack on the Kabul airport that killed over 100 people, including 13 U.S. troops. The latest study by the RAND Corporation think tank concluded that systemic weaknesses at the Department of Defense were resulting in it falling short of its duties on civilian casualties. It added that in conflicts, the U.S. military's access to targeted areas is limited both before and after strikes, and it relies on intelligence gathered remotely, using sources like drone surveillance and satellite imagery.
Well, the United States regularly violates its own and international laws about related to war. But I do think the U.S. needs to completely reevaluate its use of drones entirely. We know because of brave whistleblowers like Daniel Hale and other journalists who have reported on drones and drone use that the U.S. often uses faulty intelligence to conduct these strikes, which do result in lots of civilian casualties.
The RAND study, which was required by congressional legislation, found that the problem is compounded by the U.S. military when it fails to adequately talk to people from outside the U.S. government or armed forces who might have access to information on the ground.
The latest report by RAND says investigating civilian casualties is often delegated to the Pentagon's junior personnel who do not receive formal training. And that explains the 2018 Joint Staff Review. It had found that nearly 60% of civilian casualties identified between 2015 and 2017 came from external sources. And that definitely raises the question of accountability for the U.S., the country with the highest number of overseas military bases in the world.
After the RAND study was released, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin issued a memorandum calling for the creation of a plan on civilian harm mitigation and response in the months to come, as well as the creation of Civilian Protection Center later this year. A senior Pentagon official later admitted that the department's data-gathering strategies have been faulty and expressed the need to incorporate the figures from other sources in American tallies. The U.S. runs nearly 700 overseas military bases in at least 80 countries around the world. Such widespread military presence means that Washington has been involved in many wars, either covertly or overtly, to secure its interests. Those wars almost always result in many civilian casualties. The question is how the U.S. is planning to reduce the number of civilians who pay the cost of the war on their country with their lives.
Yeah, I think for many reasons the U.S. needs to completely reevaluate its foreign policy. We need to move away from war first and foremost because of the impact it has internationally on countries like Yemen and Afghanistan and other countries the U.S. has been involved in a war inside of in the last few years. Also, the environmental impact of war. War and militarism is driving the climate crisis. And also, we need to do things in the United States, like cut the Pentagon budget to move us away from war and put more money towards things that actually matter, like free healthcare for all Americans and that sort of thing.
That being said, the simplest solution to the problem of civilian casualties overseas seems to be not conducting any such operations in the first place, as the U.S. military's track record in accepting accountability is far from acceptable, and at the same time, the countries where the U.S. has deployed troops in are calling for their withdrawal.
Now moving on, Israeli President Yitzhak Herzog is in the UAE for talks with leaders of the Arab country. Greeting Herzog and Abu Dhabi UAE's Foreign Minister Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed held the visit as one more huge step toward a successful relationship. Herzog, the first Israeli president to visit the Sheikh, will be meeting with top Emirati officials, including Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed. The UAE, along with Bahrain, established diplomatic relations with Israel 2 years ago in U.S. broker deals. Palestinians regard normalization as a betrayal of their cause. Israeli media is saying that Herzog will use his two-day stay to encourage more Persian Gulf Arab nations to normalize ties with Tel Aviv. And the trip follows another one by Prime Minister Naftali Bennett in December. The UK is planning to commit more forces and weapons to the NATO alliance for deployment in Eastern Europe amid rising tensions with Russia over Ukraine. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says that the move will send a clear message to the Kremlin that London won't tolerate what he described as Moscow's destabilizing activities. The offer will be made to NATO military chiefs next week. The deployment will include warships, jets, and military hardware. Britain may also double its forces in Eastern European countries, from the current 1,150. Relations between Russia and the West have been at their lowest since the Cold War. NATO insists that Russia has deployed tens of thousands of troops on the border in preparation for an invasion of Ukraine. Moscow says it has the right to move forces on its own soil because its security is at risk from NATO's eastward enlargement and military activities. The crisis over Ukraine keeps unraveling amid a stand-up between the U.S.-led NATO and Russia. The U.S. has already sent several batches of military supplies to Kiev. It's planning to dispatch troops to Eastern Europe, too. Several U.S. allies have also put their forces on alert over what they call a possible Russian invasion of Ukraine. Meantime, corporate media are portraying Moscow as an aggressor while ignoring how the West has been threatening Russian security with military drills and weapons buildup near its border. Let's take a closer look.
Ukraine, a country in Eastern Europe, making the headlines these days as it remains a source of friction between its neighbor Russia and backers in the US-led NATO alliance. Corporate media have been trying to portray Russia as an aggressor, bombarding their audience with reports on the country's troop deployment at the border, its military drills, as well as moving blood supplies to Ukraine. Can the international community fall into yet another war trap in a scenario set by the West on a likely Russian invasion of Ukraine? But the question is, given the US-led NATO's eastward expansion and transfer of their lethal weapons and troops bases in Eastern Europe, which one is the real aggressor, NATO or Russia?
When the Soviet Union fell and the Warsaw Pact had already been ended, since then, NATO has added 14 more countries, and nearly all of them are countries that were either republics of the Soviet Union or allies of the Soviet Union.
Ukraine is simply a pawn on the Western chessboard. The U.S. has already sent several consignments of weapons as part of a multi-million dollar security aid to Ukraine while planning more troop deployment. America's allies, Britain, France, and others, have also put their forces on alert. The massive propaganda has even prompted the Ukrainian leader to urge his Western counterparts to avoid stirring panic over a Russia invasion. The West claims Russia is building up troops at the border to invade Ukraine. Moscow denies any such plan, saying its troop mobilization is simply defensive. It says the buildup also aims to counter NATO aggression. The military alliance has conducted several war games near Russian borders, three of them jointly with Ukraine, which is not even a member of the military alliance. So, what's the real game plan? Analysts believe the U.S. wants to integrate Ukraine into the American Empire by granting it a NATO membership, a message hidden in Washington's response to Moscow's security proposals.
This makes the Russians see red spots before their eyes, the same way as any talk of Mexico, say, joining a Chinese military alliance would make them freak out in Washington. It's not a difficult problem.
Russia is seeking to reassert its place in the international arena, and its proposals for a diplomatic resolution to the Ukraine standoff seem reasonable. A possible military conflict between the European Union and Russia would entail massive human losses and economic harms. Undoubtedly, Russia has grown increasingly concerned about its security because of Western weapons and forces deployed to its doorstep. The corporate media have played a vital part in fueling tensions, and the U.S., that has waged numerous wars overseas, knows very well how dangerous provoking a war with Russia will be.
Now moving on to Portugal, where polling stations have opened in the snap legislative elections. The vote was called in November after Parliament rejected the socialist government's budget bill. It's being held as the ruling socialists continue to lose their lead in opinion polls to the main opposition party, that's the center-right Social Democrats. But politics aside, the ballot is taking place amid fears of the spread of the coronavirus, with the country reporting record-breaking daily cases. Over a million people are in isolation due to COVID. However, the government has announced those infected are allowed to leave their homes to vote. Strict health protocols remain in place to ensure the safety of the voters. Sergio Mattarella has been re-elected as Italian president, ending a week of political squabbling among party leaders. His acceptance to stay for a second mandate has pulled Italy out of a quagmire that would otherwise erode the government's credibility.
Mattarella. Mattarella.
After 6 days of failed votes and 8 rounds of ballots, on Saturday the Italian parliament re-elected 80-year-old Sergio Mattarella as president of the republic with 759 votes out of 983 cast by the grand electors. In the days ahead of the election, Mattarella, who has been in office since 2015, had repeatedly said that he didn't want another stint. However, he changed his mind on Saturday afternoon when the leaders of parliamentary groups resorted to him in a desperate attempt to put an end to a political impasse that would erode the nation's credibility.
I was expecting him to win. He is a beacon of reliability and balance.
At the beginning of the election, I would have never guessed it. But when Draghi's chances to be elected started to appear slim, I realized that Mattarella could be the one.
The political stalemate was triggered by parties' disagreement over the candidacy of Prime Minister Draghi to be the next president earlier in the week. In the following days, parties struggled to reach an agreement over an alternative figure, dragging the country on the verge of a political crisis. Commentators have slammed political leaders for the bickering over a consensus candidate. Some have said that not even during a pandemic crisis which has brought the country to its knees, political parties have been able to put aside their differences.
Politicians squandered a huge amount of time amid divisions and rivalries to get back to square one with Mattarella as president and Draghi as prime minister. 8 rounds of balloting have left deep scars with potentially dangerous repercussions for political stability. I'm expecting some ministers to be replaced.
Prime Minister Draghi is expected to reshuffle his cabinet as his first move following Mattarella's election. He has to make sure that the 260 billion euros that Italy is receiving from the European Recovery Fund to counter the economic fallout of the COVID-19 crisis are spent effectively. Draghi has committed to 58 reforms and 132 investments over the next 5 years. Max Civili, Rome.
And that's all for this edition from Tehran.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
torture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we saw how herbicides used by the Australian government decimated its employees and left children and partners critically ill. Assured by the government that it was safe, it was common for Australian workers in the 60s and 70s to use toxic herbicides without using proper protective clothing. Since then, a terrifyingly high number of these former government employees have died or become seriously ill, almost certainly as a result of their constant exposure to dioxin, a deadly chemical impurity found in herbicide 2,4,5-T. Of course, 2,4,5-T has now been banned, but stay with us as we investigate how a lack of regulation and testing of cheap imports means potentially deadly levels of the dioxin may still be present in weed control products today.
You'll clear that and left me.
Yep.
Molly Dunn believes she knows more than most in Yarram about the toxic aftermath of spraying 2,4,5-T and 2,4-D. She had a stillborn baby 5 months into a pregnancy. At the time, her husband Percy Dunn was a sprayer for the Victorian Lands Department at Yarram.
They didn't actually have protective clothing back then. No clothes, no masks, no nothing much, you know.
Percy Dunn died of cancer in 1980. The 60-year-old had been ill for many years after spraying the herbicides in paddocks and along creeks to kill blackberries and ragwort weed infestations. 2 years after he died, Molly took the Victorian government to court and was awarded $17,500 in workers' compensation. But no liability was admitted. All these years later, she's still grieving his death. Percy Dunn's family is believed to be the only one in Yarram to have received government compensation.
Do you think it's wrong that families like yours only get compensation when they're prepared to go to court?
Yeah, well, that's the government, you know. They don't want to pay out anything unless they have to.
And there'd be surpluses in those drums too.
It's very similar to the asbestos cases that I've been involved in. The denial is put forward and the worker's got a battle to prove beyond reasonable doubt. And it's very hard to do in chemical cases.
In Yarram, many of the sprayers have died.
Very short breath, though.
Yeah, well, me too.
Tony Cassidy and Pat Reed are the lucky ones, sick but still alive.
Anyway, he's looking at you, Doc.
Righto.
I've got cancer of the bladder. In fact, I've got to go tomorrow for more exploratory surgery.
How many of your mates that you used to spray with have been sick or have died?
Oh, well, all of them are sick. Some are probably not as sick as me, but they're all sick. And I'd say probably 75% of them have died.
Any breeze where you've got it all over you. You're wet through some bloody days.
What, just covered in stuff?
Yeah.
Sprayer Pat Reed thinks he was unwittingly dragged into a cover-up when he was told by his boss to bury about 80 of the drums on Crown land just outside of Yarram.
Tree over there to clean up.
Oh, right, okay.
About there.
About there?
Yeah.
Pat took us to the site of where he buried them more than 30 years ago.
They put the axe through them up on the truck and threw them into the hole and they crunched them up with the dozer and then filled it all in.
Nothing there.
We knew there was something going on, digging a hole out to put drums in, so something funny.
Out in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah.
Why do you think the Lands Department asked the men to bury the drums?
Drums there.
Because the heat was on. Get rid of them. We don't want them on the premises because people were starting to snip around and ask questions.
It should never have been used for manual spraying or aerial spraying. It was a poison that you couldn't contain.
It wasn't until the 1990s that 2,4,5-T, which was thought to be more toxic than 2,4-D, was banned by all states in Australia. This was some years after the United States took it off its market. What made 2,4,5-T so toxic was the heating of the reaction mixture during manufacture, which created dangerous dioxins.
You can not ensure that dioxins are not being formed even if you employ the best production processes. I think this is one of the reasons why 245T was banned, because what you require is an additional step, which is a purification step, and that is relatively costly.
Kills the entire weed, roots and all.
What many people don't realise is that the second chemical in Agent Orange, 24D, which was developed in the 1940s, is still widely used.
A plane dusts a field of young wheat with 24D.
24D is a cheap and effective weed killer.
The destruction of many weeds is complete.
There are more than 200 24D products registered in Australia.
It's used in many agricultural applications. It's used in pastures and cropland for broadleaf control. It's also used in areas that people probably wouldn't expect, such as turf spraying for sporting fields, for councils in their cosmetic applications, for verges and those sorts of things.
Many of the major chemical companies are represented by a peak body, CropLife Australia.
Weeds are a massive cost. If you had to manage them in other ways, we're talking, you know, just for a normal farm, thousands of work hours.
Hey there.
Hi.
So, this is a sample.
Great.
It's generally assumed that there's no dangerous dioxins in 24D due to today's improved manufacturing standards. But 3 years ago, a team of Queensland scientists set out to prove there were no dioxins in pesticides and were amazed at what they discovered.
We actually didn't believe the results. We said there must have been a cross-contamination because these levels are not possible anymore today. They were, for some of the pesticides, similar to what was known from 245T, which was banned in the 80s, 90s.
Associate Professor Carolyn Gauss sent her researchers back to the laboratory to repeat the tests. And when they returned positive, she expanded the study to include other pesticides, including 24D. Tests on one 24D product came back showing moderate levels of dioxins. This product was made by a Brisbane company, but it may have had its active ingredient imported. There's no way of knowing, as the regulator classifies this as commercial in confidence. Many Australian companies today import their active ingredients from countries like China and India.
What that really means is that it depends on the manufacturer, as well as the year of manufacture, as well as the batch or the country of manufacture, on how much dioxin you actually produce or have left as an impurity in the 24D formulation.
We've been told many, many times over the years that industry has cleaned up its act, that they have new processing equipment, new techniques, new technology that will eliminate dioxin from their herbicides and therefore from our environment. But I think the latest studies that are showing these contaminant levels indicate that that's not the case, that industry hasn't come clean about the nature of the contaminants of dioxin in 24D, and the government really needs to take a close look at this.
Despite the low to moderate levels found in 24D, its widespread use rang alarm bells.
So if you have a moderate toxicity but you use very high volumes, then the risk could be the same as having very high toxicity but very low volume of use.
24D was tested, and the level of dioxins that were found were lower than elsewhere in the world. So that gave us some comfort.
That gave you some comfort?
Some comfort.
That they found moderate levels of dioxin in 24D.
That it was low to moderate.
The regulator, the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, decided to see for itself if dioxins were present. It repeated the Queensland tests.
The APVMA came in and also tested for dioxins in a range of chemicals, and we worked with the health department as well in assessing the outcomes of that.
When you tested, did you find dioxins as well?
I understand understand that when the testing was done, we did find some levels of dioxins, and that's when it's been referred to the health department.
Did you find it in 2,4-D?
I would have to... I don't know the answer to that question.
Exposure to dioxin is consistent with this pattern of adverse health effects, and I think that there are solid scientific reasons to be concerned about dioxin exposures following 2,4-D use.
Four Corners decided to test for dioxin contamination in one of the many imported products. We purchased 2,4-D weed killer from this warehouse in Sunshine just outside of Melbourne and sent it to government laboratories for testing. The 2,4-D weed killer, Aminos-625, was imported from China by an Australian company, Senonda, based in an office in Melbourne. We purchased the 2,4-D weed killer, which is often sold direct to farmers, no questions asked.
It's almost 3 weeks on, and we've just received our results from the government laboratory. Alarmingly, our sample of 2,4-D weed killer came back with dioxin levels almost 7 times higher than those found by the Queensland scientists. And what's even more disturbing is we don't know how many contaminated 2,4-D products are out there in the community because authorities are not routinely testing.
Four Corners gave the results to Associate Professor Carolyn Gauss to analyse.
I was actually surprised because you only analysed one formulation and actually returned such a high result. I thought it was unlikely today, but again, that is a reality check when we think back to our previous study where we actually didn't expect any contamination in the pesticides. It just demonstrates again that what we're seeing today is equally or even worse than 10 to 20 years ago, and that is of concern, of course.
Each year, more than $100 million worth of 2,4-D products are sold in Australia, and we don't know which ones contain imported ingredients.
We have seen a new scenario develop in Australia with high Australian dollar, massive production increase in places like China, and fairly free trade between the two countries, that a large amount of product is now coming in. The country of origin, as I suggested, doesn't automatically imply good or bad. What we do need to ensure is that we deal with reliable suppliers.
But it's not just about having a reliable supplier. Scientists say we should be monitoring for dioxins in all pesticides. And that's the job of the regulator.
Without monitoring each of the batches or regular monitoring, we pretty much don't have any chance to really realise what is being on the market and how much of the dioxin is being released with pesticide use.
The APVMA hasn't found any evidence of high levels of dioxin in imported chemicals.
Are you testing for it?
The APVMA doesn't do independent testing. However, it is concerns about potential quality of imported goods is often referred to us from many different sources.
But how do you know if they've got dangerous dioxins in them?
If there were high levels of dioxins, it would affect the final chemical, and we would expect to see in the public use concerns about the efficacy or the chemical itself, and we're not seeing that.
Who should test for dioxin in these imports, the companies or the regulator?
Well, I would suggest that any regulatory system should have an independent testing regime to it.
We also don't know how much 2,4-D is being sprayed around Australia.
The lack of volume data makes it really hard to make any kind of sensible risk management decisions. If you've got a chemical where there's an identified problem and you don't know how much is being used or where it's used or in what circumstances it's being used, it's very difficult to develop sensible regulatory, make sensible regulatory decisions.
I would suggest to you those who are advocating the need for it don't realise that it's actually not necessary, or in fact you're just going to bury the regulator in data and them not able to make a good decision.
Regardless of how much is sprayed, it's too much for David Brewer, an organic wine producer in South Australia's Riverland. Last year at Loxton, he lost his entire harvest because 2,4-D sprayed on another property drifted onto his grapes. David Brewer used to lecture in chemistry at Roseworthy Agricultural College in South Australia.
But just a foreign chemical. It's something that we would have no part of, and yet it's on our grapes. It's on our sultanas. And it can only have come from somebody else's property. It's a trespass.
Tests found that David Brewer's table grapes had very small residues of 2,4-D. But he's concerned it could have been one of the cheaper generic imported products. What is it about these imported 2,4-D products that are so attractive?
Well, A, they're cheap. They're cheaper to start with, and B, they go further, so they're more efficient, if you like, in killing weeds.
But more effective in contaminating other properties as
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a real problem. Like, once it's finished at their place, it comes over here and has a go at ours.
There was a ban on spraying 2,4-D esters, the most prone to drift, at the time David Brewer's grapes were contaminated. It's almost impossible to trace the origins of vapour drift, as it can travel up to 100 kilometres.
Well, most cases of spray drift are usually because people aren't obeying what's on the label, or it could be accidental.
2,4-D drift has damaged thousands of hectares of cotton, market gardens and vineyards around the country. The South Australian market gardener, who does not want to be named for fear of losing customers, says he is constantly losing produce from drift from farms as far as 10 kilometres away.
Cos lettuce growing nicely.
Bottom line is, they can't use a chemical that does damage to other people. There's no compensation for anybody that gets damaged, so it should really be eliminated.
You can see the weird growth deformations. It's got these protruding growths sticking up from the side of the tomato.
This grower says the drift is causing many deformities in his vegetables.
You've got female where they're supposed to be male, so they're mixed up with the pollen. And you also do get corn deformities where you'll get multiple cobs on a single cob.
The mysterious part of it is that 2,4-D can render significant damage to a vineyard, a cherry orchard, a tomato field, at levels that can't be measured in the air. It's that toxic to plants, particularly if the drift and exposure episode occurs when the plant is going through the fruiting stage. In other words, the plant's flowering, beginning to form fruit.
7 years ago, the Australian regulator put restrictions on when and how 2,4-D high volatile esters could be sprayed. But the complaints of drift continued. Curiously, the day Four Corners was to interview the regulator, it announced a proposed ban on high volatile esters.
We're going through a show cause process to ask industry to come back to us with why these chemicals should still be available, and from then we will make the decision about the future of the chemicals in Australia.
But some believe a ban will not go far enough, as there are other forms of 2,4-D that may drift that are still on the market. The APVMA started a review of 2,4-D in 1995 because of concerns about its potential harmful effects on humans, animals, and the environment. It's yet to finish that review. Why do you announce that you're going to review a chemical in 1995, but you don't do anything until 2006?
As I mentioned, I can't comment on what was behind that announcement. Typically when you come to chemical review, if you're concerned about a chemical, you do announce to the public that you are looking at such a chemical.
11 years ahead of time.
That sort of time frame is perhaps unusual.
Australia's regulator must walk a fine line between arming farmers with the best tools and protecting the community from potentially dangerous chemicals. Today, there's almost 10,000 agricultural chemicals used in Australia. Some, like 2,4-D, have been around for generations.
It is not acceptable that chemicals take 10 or 15 years for review when there have been identified problems with them.
What are the risks?
Well, the risks are that unsafe chemicals are being continually put in the environment, being used in farming communities, and we are eating those in the food that we eat. ¶¶
some would say the time to take a risk with these old chemicals is over. Certainly Nigel Sinclair and his family believed this. Tragically, Nigel never got the answers he was seeking. He died shortly after our interview.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that it is an unfair equation to lose valuable human life just to get rid of weeds. And that's it for this week's program. Thank you for your time and attention. Remember that you can contact us through our email or better yet through Facebook and Twitter. Until next week and another Aperture, it's goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Brothers and sisters, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam. Very short, concise, to the point, and thought-provoking. His Eminence says, every single thing you face in life is a test. Let that sink in. While you're doing that, let's listen to a short story related to this matter, and we're going to be right back.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear friends, we have a nice story for this part. Thank you very much for listening to Lantern. The title of today's story is Marble Statue. In the middle of a beautiful city, there was a museum laid with beautiful marble tiles and with a huge marble statue as a part of the display. Many people from all over the world visited the museum every day and admired the beautifully crafted statue. One night, the marble tiles started talking to the marble statue. Marble tiles. "Hey, statue, don't you think that it is just not fair that everybody from all over the world come all the way here to admire you while ignoring and stepping on me?" Marble statue. "My dear brother, marble tile, don't you remember we are actually from the same cave?" Marble tile. "Yes, I do. It is why I feel it is even more unfair. Both of us were born from the same cave, and yet the world treats us so differently now. This is so unfair." Marble statue said, "Yes, you're right, my brother, but do you still remember the day when the sculptor tries to work on you, but you resisted his tools?" "Yes, I despise that guy. How could he use those nasty tools on me?" "Well, since you resisted his tools, he couldn't work on you. When he decided to give up on you, he started working on me instead. He knew at once that I would be something different and unique after his efforts. He bore all the painful tools he used on me and allowed him craft me, and he wanted. But those tools were so painful." "My brother, there is a price for everything in life. Since he decided to resist and gave up halfway, you can't blame anybody who steps on you now." The marble tiles silently listened to his brother's words and started to reflect on it. "Dear brothers and sisters, the harder the knocks you go through in life, the more you learn and put them to use in the future. Do not be discouraged by setbacks and failures. Keep trying to be better. The most beautiful people we have known are those who have known defeat, known suffering, known struggle, known loss, and have found their way out of those depths." That was a nice quote by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Thank you very much for listening to our story and the continuation of Lantern.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So you were saying how Imam Ali alayhi salam has said that everything you face in life is a test. Everyone's pain is valid. But by looking at the Ahlul Bayt, we're taught how to better cope with this pain and how to handle it and grow through it. Now, I am not in any way trying to normalize or romanticize pain and suffering. It shouldn't be this way, but for the time being, it is what it is, and best we can do is develop the necessary skill set to deal with it. Perhaps one day when the last proof of Allah upon this earth returns, he will, and humanity reaches its highest degree of intellect and compassion and justice, there will no longer be pain. But then, even then, there'd still be death. And we'd still have to deal with loss of loved ones, loss of people we relied on, we cared for. There's still going to be some sort of pain. It's an integral, inseparable, inevitable part of life. And since we can't remove it, we have to learn how to deal with it. And dealing with it means being able to step out of that storm a better person, as a better, stronger, more compassionate person. So those were two points. Point number three is that what could help us is knowing that Allah is always watching. He doesn't neglect us for a single moment. He doesn't forget none of the battles that we go through in life. And none of the things we have to grapple with goes unnoticed to Him. And He remembers all of it. And when the time comes, He will compensate for us in ways we could never imagine. Another important lesson that we need to learn as civilized human beings from the process of suffering is compassion. An active, productive, progressive yearning for justice. Dealing with trauma and calamities in life is really, really hard. But not to shame and blame or judge anyone, but if we cannot come out of that as better people, kinder people, more sympathetic people, then perhaps that suffering has been in vain and we've low-key failed. I'm not talking about a certain degree of trauma so intolerable that makes the person snap and totally hinders their sanity. I'm not talking about that sort of trauma. I'm talking about one that is within reasonable bounds and is still possible to somehow collect the pieces of ourselves from during the aftermath and try to put them back together in a way that would reflect us best, reflect our humanity and our moral values best, because that's what determines our worth as human beings. For us to be kind and generous and gracious and thankful and smiley and lovey-dovey when everything is going the way we want it to, when we're rich and healthy and young and beautiful and surrounded by friends and families and loved ones and pets, that's great and all, but that's like no big hoopla. You haven't done anything special. However, the ability, the power to remain compassionate and sympathetic toward other human beings, to step out of a trauma, step out of a storm with our humanity intact, that's a special deed. And that makes us a special person. And I think that's what defines our success. I'd say let us know what you think, but then I have no idea how to hear from you guys. Anyway, thank you so very much for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.